Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Redemption Hill podcast. We are a community of people learning the way of Jesus to bless our city of Boise, Idaho, and beyond. Redemption Hill is a unique place. We are a collective of micro churches that do life together throughout the week and gather on Sundays to grow, worship, and celebrate what God is doing in our city. You are invited to join us Sundays at 9 a.m. at Discovery Church in Boise, where you can find the community you need in any season of your life. More details can be found at redemptionboise.org. Up next is the teaching segment from this week's Sunday gathering. Afterwards, stay tuned for more information on how to get connected at Redemption Hill.
Welcome to our fourth week of Advent, which, as Clint pointed out this morning, my dad usually encourages us to do in January because we're talking about the wise men and there's the Epiphany, but we're doing it this week, so I'm sorry if you're upset. I know you are. My name is Jesse Horney, and I'm one of the pastors for our community here at Redemption Hill. And I have loved this Advent series, and you know, we like wrote the whole kids' nativity play around the idea of responding to God's initiative and God's movement in our lives. And as I was thinking about this sermon today, I realized that sometimes we jump in with some assumptions about what we believe, which isn't helpful. So I'm going to start us with these questions, because you need to know what you think about this before you know what you think about the rest of the story. So, thinking about God speaking to us and our response presupposes, like, first of all, do I believe that God speaks? Do I know how to hear what he's saying? And then, do I care enough to respond? So there's a little bit of a settling that we have to do inside of those questions before we can move on. But I'm going to tell you, just for my sake and because I have the microphone, that I do believe that God speaks. And I have been learning over many years to hear what he's saying and practicing. And I want to care enough to respond. So those are my answers to those questions as we move into this sermon. We're talking about the wise men today, who are kind of a strange part of the Christmas story. Literally, they're strangers. They're foreigners. They are very far away from the central part of the story, you know, which is Bethlehem and where Mary and Joseph are growing up. These guys are very far away. And so part of what we're looking at today is, how did they know what was going on, and why did they care enough to respond? Because I don't want to skip over that. I don't want to assume that anyone who saw what the wise men saw would do what the wise men did, because I don't think we would. We're talking today about responding, but what I really want to center ourselves on today is becoming. Because how we respond to life and to people determines who we become. Every interaction that we have with each other, your approach to me, my approach back to you, what you say to me, what I say back to you, these responses, these conversations, these actions that we take are forming us. And so ultimately, the idea of God's speaking and us responding is that in our response to God, we are becoming something. Always. Even in our non-response to God, we're becoming something. So I want you to think about your life right now. The pace of your life, your natural reactions to the people around you, your weariness or your joy, how you spend your time, who you surround yourself with. And then if I asked you this question, how do you think you would answer it? What have you become? There's a famous saying from the 19th century poet William Blake, who was a weird guy, but I think he was a prophetic poet. You've heard this before. It came to my mind a few days ago, and I couldn't remember where it was from, but he famously said, "We become what we behold." And so when we think about what have I become, the root of that question is, what have I been beholding? This is important because the Advent story and the Christmas story isn't just like a cute story that happened a long time ago. It's not even like a radical story that we repeat to ourselves to stay strong in our faith. Advent is about what we're becoming right now. Because we're still becoming. We're becoming always. You're never going to reach a point where you stop becoming. So Advent is a reminder that we are being formed right now, and how we respond to God is the strongest indicator of our formation. I'm going to read the verses about the wise men because I want you to listen for a few words, okay? And I want you to pay attention to some things that are important about them. I know you just heard it this morning from Danica, but I'm going to read it again. Oh, not up there. Shoot, darn, my glasses on. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, remember that central location, during the reign of King Herod. About that time, some wise men came from eastern lands and arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn King of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him." King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious laws and asked, "Where's the Messiah supposed to be born? Just remind me." "In Bethlehem in Judea," they said, "for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, O Bethlehem, the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah, for a ruler will come from you, who will be the shepherd for my people Israel." Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. And then he told them, "Go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child. And when you find him, come back and tell me so I can go and worship him too." I always have to read it in that voice. After this interview, the wise men went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were filled with joy. They entered the house and saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasure chests and gave him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. And when it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. What really struck me when I read this week, and I had to ask some other friends who are pastors about it, was why they worshiped Jesus, the wise men. I don't know why that has never stuck out to me before, but did they really believe he was a king? Because they weren't from the Jewish tradition. So even if they did believe he was a king, why did they care? Because they weren't Jews. Like, he wasn't going to be their king. He wasn't going to have any jurisdiction over them. And a lot was going to have to happen for Jesus to even become a king. Did they, like, really believe he was going to overthrow Rome? It really struck me that that was their reaction to this baby living in poverty with his mom and dad, that they still went and worshiped him. And I was also really curious about who these wise men were. Like, why would they have made this trek? Did kind of a deep dive on the word wise men this week, because this isn't the only time that it's used in the Bible. Wise men is actually like a really ancient job, basically. Men who watched the stars, men who could predict what was coming. The book of Daniel is full of them. And they were important because they were people who watched. I could never be a wise man. Even though you guys know I like space, it would have been so boring to me to always be thinking about what was to come and never really entering into what was happening. But these wise men were different because they did think that it was something to come, but they decided to enter into the story right then and there. And they're only in this story for one reason, because I know they weren't the only person that saw that star. I know they weren't the only three wise men watching the skies. They were from the east. There were lots of wise men watching the skies. They probably told lots of other people about it, but other people didn't believe enough to come. The wise men are in this story because they were paying attention and they responded. They saw that something was happening and they decided to do something about it. Their worship, really at its core, started with recognition, which is how all worship begins. We recognize that something seems worthy, not just God, like a relationship that we worship, or a political power that we worship, or a way of life that we worship. The first thing that we do is recognize that that thing has some worth to us. And the wise men recognized that there was something worthy in what was happening in the skies. Herod also recognized what was going on, though. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been worried about it. There is something about what the wise men said that was enough for Herod to respond. He didn't respond with murder. He did respond with murder. He didn't respond with worship. If you read a little bit further, he's going to murder every boy 2 years old and under in the surrounding area to make sure that this new king of the Jews did not live. So Herod recognized and he responded. But he responded out of fear. Also, what I've never noticed is that all of Jerusalem also heard this news. In my mind, in this story, it's just the wise men in a private council with Herod. But it says that all these religious leaders knew. So it's been like whispered on the streets for a long time that something might be going on with Jesus from the time of his infancy. But Jerusalem heard and ignored it. It's the exact same moment, it's the exact same thing happening, but with different responses. And as usual, just like we've been talking about, God initiates, and this time he initiates not with an angel and not with a pregnancy, but with a star. And I wanted to know what this star looked like, because there's like a lot of argument about what it might have been. And there's actually ancient Chinese records from the year like around 5 BC, which would have been around the time that Jesus was born, that there was this thing called like a long-term comet. I put up a picture for you. This is that same kind of a comet in 2020 in Arizona. So this is recorded happening around the time that Jesus was born, this kind of a celestial activity. And this kind of a comet moves through the sky. There's no proof that this is really what was happening, but this picture made me cry a little bit when I saw it, because it, while Jesus' birth and his entrance into the earth was so like gritty and real, there was also a lot happening in the cosmos. And in the book of Revelation, it actually like peels back what's happening when Jesus is born, and there's like a huge war that's happening in the cosmos. So I love that God used creation and the universe to speak to the wise men to tell them where to go. Like, he will not stop at getting our attention. He will send angels. He will send cousins. He will send stars. He will make a donkey talk. He will do whatever it takes to get our attention because he knows that when he speaks to us and we respond back to him, it forms us in his likeness. Responding to this star was not a casual thing for the wise men to do. I think I put up a picture of their journey, maybe. Okay, so they're from the east, probably, like, it could have been as far away as China, but probably more like Persia, like right around where it says Babylon. And then they had to get all the way over to Jerusalem, Bethlehem. This was a very long trek. I also found a funny picture of plugging it into Google Maps, and if you said you wanted to walk, how long that would take. Just imagining the wise men using that made me laugh, sorry. Paying attention to what God was doing and responding required a complete reorientation of what they were doing with their lives. It required a complete reorientation of what they believed about their resources and even their loyalties. And our response to God is going to require the same thing. How are we orienting our lives? How are we orienting our resources? What are we doing with our loyalties? This is the real answer to what we're beholding. What are we aiming towards? What resources are we using and hoarding? And where do our loyalties lie? That will tell you where your eyes are at. What's really important to remember, you can take that down, Caitlin, is that attention, paying attention, is never neutral. I want us to think about that for a second. Attention is never neutral. As much as we would like to believe that we can receive information from the world in a passive stance, this is simply not true based on brain science and based on our experience. We know that the things that we receive begin to form us. We now know that what Scripture says has always been true, that our minds and hearts are shaped by what we repeatedly focus upon. The Bible has said that forever. Now science is like, you know what, you guys? What you focus on is what you become. Jesus is like, I know, I told you that so long ago. So we know about neuroplasticity. We talk about that all the time, that our minds are plastic. We can create new pathways. We are constantly being reformed and grooved to the habits and patterns of our lives. We also know, you guys have probably heard this term before, we know that we fire mirror neurons when we're talking to people. You know, like if you are having a feeling when I'm talking to you and you change your face, I'm going to change my face too. If a kid is watching a parent model kindness, that kid is going to also model kindness. Not just because they want to be like their mom and dad, but because their brain is telling them to do it. Watching cruelty will train us to be cruel. Being neglected will teach us to neglect. What we consume teaches us who to be. Attention is never neutral. Beholding is not passive. Your nervous system is rehearsing the life it observes. We are quite literally being neurologically discipled, there's a phrase, by what we see, by what we consume. Very importantly, we are being neurologically discipled by our own thoughts. The things that we think over and over and over again are deepening these pathways in our brains over and over and over again, so that every time I experience the same stimuli, I'm going to give it the same response because I've been digging this trench in my mind with fear, with anxiety, with anger. And I do it for so long and I do it for so often that then I think, oh, that's just who I am. I am a frantic person. I am an angry person. I am a passive person. Is this true, or is it because of what I've been beholding in my own mind and believing in my own mind. Attention is never neutral. What you behold, you eventually move toward, and what you move toward, you will begin to resemble. Have you ever met people who have been married for 50 years and they look the same? Yes, it's because when they're with each other, they are beginning to use the same language. They're using the same inside jokes. They're literally mirroring each other's faces during conversations for 50 years. And all of the micro muscles in their faces have been moving the same way for so long that they do look like each other. It's not a joke. The things that we behold, we will become. We don't just look at things. They look back at us and they remake us. There was this popular book that came out pretty recently describing something called the habit loop that I put up here. If you've been in counseling, your counselor has probably talked to you about this. Or if you've ever like tried to lose weight, this is a big piece of like the psychological piece of losing weight. So this is the human experience. We experience a cue, something that sets us off. And then we will go to our routine. What do we normally do when we experience that cue? And then we'll experience some kind of a reward. And then that reward will send us right back to the same cue because we loved the reward. Can you think of an area of your life that looks like this? I'm going to tell you an embarrassing one for me, okay? Turn off the podcast. Just kidding. It's not that embarrassing. Pretty recently, I had to get off Instagram for like 6 weeks. And in my life, a rule that I've set for myself is between the hours of like 4 and 8 p.m., if I'm going to be on my phone for anything other than a phone call, I have to leave the room that my family's in. And I started doing this a few years ago because I knew that when I'm on my phone, I'm not in the room my family's in, but it's kind of like a bastardized version of presence. Like I'm still sitting by my kids, but I'm looking at my phone. So if I want to use my phone, I have to remove myself so that my body can feel what I've actually done, which is to remove myself from the room. But a few months ago, I realized that not only was I spending like a lot of time in another room, not with my family, I was also like keeping the lights off so they didn't know which room I was in so that I could be on Instagram. And it was usually right around like 7:45 to 8:15 when, if you have kids, you know, that's like, is your homework done? Are the dishes done? Are you guys going to bed? And I didn't want to deal with it. It was the end of a long day, and I was soothing myself with the routine of looking at Instagram, and the reward is that Instagram is, like, so fun. And it's not, it requires nothing of me. I can just flip, flip, flip. It's making me laugh. I'm just not present. And so the reward was really this, like, disassociation from my real life. But every night at the same time, the cue of the stress that I was feeling about the next 45 minutes would remind me of the routine of going to another room and looking at my phone by myself in the dark. Ugh. And then the reward was this dopamine hit. And it just became such a groove in my life that the only thing I could do was like delete the app off my phone, and I couldn't look at it for a long time. And what was crazy was how much my hand thought that Instagram was still on my phone. Because I'd be sitting there and I'd pick it up and my tired little thumb would try to flip to the screen that I keep it on. And there'd be nothing there. I was just like incessantly checking my email because I was so bored on my phone. There was nothing to do. I was looking at my pictures all the time, crying over my kids growing up. Because there was nothing to do, and the cue in my body was like, I'm bored or I'm stressed, and the routine was to reach for my phone. But I had to remove the reward so that I could start to find a new pattern through the cue. Because the truth was that my attention to that thing was not neutral. My attention to that thing was the cost of connection with my family. And it was even the cost of the pain of family. Because to ignore the pain that I was feeling about being a mother, about being weary in my day, meant that I wasn't talking to anybody about it. There was no connection between me and Sam to say, this time of night is tough, and I'm avoiding the family. My attention is never neutral. There is a cost. Responding to God, if it requires this reorientation of my life and my resources and my loyalties, then what Advent is asking us to do, what it's inviting us to do, really, is to offer the most precious resource that we have available, which is our attention. Your attention, you turning towards something, is the greatest worth that you hold. You know this when you're with someone who loves you and is paying attention to you. Can you feel it? The warmth, the sense of home that we feel with those people. Simone Weil once said that attention is like the greatest generosity that we can give to each other. And it feels weird to think about us being generous to God, but Advent is God asking us to be generous to him with our attention. To listen when he is speaking. The question isn't if God is trying to get my attention. The question is, am I even noticing? I really like this quote from Dorothy Day. She's a beautiful writer. She says, in Christ's human life, there are always a few who made up for the neglect of the crowd. The shepherds did it. Their hurrying to the crib atoned for the people who would flee from Christ. The wise men did it. Their journey across the world made up for those who refused to stir one hand's breadth from the routine of their lives to go to Christ. Even the gifts the wise men brought have in themselves an obscure recompense and atonement for what would follow later in this child's life. For those who refuse to stir one hand's breadth from the routine of their lives to go to Christ. I mean, my hand could barely remove itself from the routine of my phone. I have to imagine that if I saw the star in the sky, I would not have gone to the Christ. I would have paid my bills. I would have cared for the people around me. And I would have said, surely not me. Which leads me to wonder, what am I looking for? What sign am I scanning the night skies to give me? What am I waiting for in these days? What is God trying to say to me? William Willimon, who's a preacher, says, this strange story tells us how to be receivers. The first word of the church, a people born out of so odd a nativity, is that we are receivers before we are givers. Discipleship teaches us the art of seeing our lives as gifts, and that's tough because I would rather see myself as a giver. I want power to stand on my own, take charge, set things to rights, perhaps even to help those who have nothing. I don't like picturing myself as dependent, needy, empty-handed. And because I don't like to see myself like that, I turn my attention towards anything that will relieve me of those feelings. What can I focus on? What can I orient myself towards so that I'm not the receiver? So that I am the giver? I am the one with power. For most of humanity, this is the work of our day-to-day activity, is to keep us from being dependent upon each other, to keep us from being dependent upon God. That is humiliation in the eyes of the humans. humiliation. For me to need you is, in its essence, a humbling. And so I'll do anything to stay away from it. I will go sit alone in a dark room so that I don't have to tell Sam that I'm so tired. I don't want to be empty-handed. I don't want to be needy. But the bad news about attention not being neutral is that when I am turning myself towards the things that will make me feel powerful, I am turning my back to the one who has everything I need. And Jesus has a word about this in Matthew chapter 6. Just a few short chapters later, from the Magi bowing down to this baby, he's telling the people listening to him, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." This is not just about money. Money does get us power. But really what Jesus is describing is this. I can face this thing that I think will fill me. Or I can face a God who made me and loves me and will speak to me at any cost for me to hear what he has to say. But attention is not neutral. This is what I think neutral attention would look like. I could keep one eye here and one eye here. This is the lukewarm Christian. A hand in the world trying to keep myself upright and a hand toward heaven, because I have some inkling that this isn't going to do it. But what I think Jesus is asking, what I think this story of the wise men is inviting us to remember, is that turning our attention towards God and responding to God, reorienting our bodies toward God, is what will make us like Jesus. And in the end, as a Jesus follower, this is what I want. I do not want to look more like you. I do not want to look more and more like me. I want to look more and more like Jesus. What we behold, we will become. And when we behold Jesus long enough and deep enough, we begin to look like him. And we'll know because our lives will be different. And they will sing of a God who sang from the stars. We will be people of love and joy and peace and mercy and humility. We will hunger for righteousness. The fruit of the Spirit will grow and spill out of us because we will not have room for anything else. Worship is not just singing. Worship is not reading your Bible and journaling. Worship is sustained attention to the worth of Jesus. Worship is beholding the one who is beholding you. When you turn towards God, it's not to tap him on the shoulder and say, "I came back." It's to turn into the full face and righteousness of of a God who never turned from you, ever. When I turn my attention towards God, it's not to get his attention. It's to receive the fullness of him. I have been paying attention to a lot of things this Advent that were not Jesus. All the presents, my calendar. When I really think about where my eyes are the most during the week, it is my calendar, the mighty calendar. Not my phone anymore, because I had to delete Instagram before it was my phone. So the question that I wanted to end with today, before the worship team comes up, is this Advent, these next few days, how will you offer Jesus your attention? And what will you have to turn your attention from in order to give it back to him? What is filling your time? What is filling your thoughts? And what would it look like to reorient away from it? Is it a practical thing? Is it deleting an app? Is it a practical thing in erasing something from your calendar, adding something to your calendar that you've been avoiding? We're going to ask the Lord, okay? Maybe he'll send a comment. I don't know. Just kidding, he won't. We're inside. But we're going to listen, okay? Just for a minute. And then the worship team's going to come up and we'll take communion. But if we become what we behold, we want to behold you. And if there is something in our line of sight, if there is something taking up the space in our thoughts that is not of you, reveal it to us now, Father. Speak to us with clarity, with authority. We are your people and we are listening. This is a little weird, but I have like a sense that maybe for some of us, it's ourselves. Like I have a picture of a mirror in my head. And the thing upon which we gaze is ourselves. So if that resonates with you, I just want to tell you that the Lord is in the mirror with you. And Jesus would love to gently turn your face towards his, because his reflection back to you about you will be more true than anything you've ever seen in a mirror. Thank you, Jesus, that there is no shame or condemnation for those who call on your name. We release any heaviness or burden that we have in knowing that we have not been beholding you, and we turn our faces towards the one who calls us beloved and redeemed. And if you had a word for us today, Jesus, we receive it. Just like the wise men, and we will respond. We will be a people who go into the streets and respond, who go to our homes and respond, Lord. We want more of you, Lord. Make us receivers, Jesus.
Thanks again for listening. Make sure to subscribe to get the weekly episodes in your podcast feed. You can find out more on how to get connected with Redemption Hill at redemptionboise.org/connection, where you can fill out the Connect card and start your journey today. For regular encouragement throughout the week, follow us on Instagram at Redemption Boise. We are so glad you're here and are excited to accompany you in your story with God. We hope to see you soon.